full and functional website to promote your books and brand, reach out to Jin today. His work includes tailored, expertly designed professional author websites. I finally have a website I'm proud to share. And we've got a special offer for Words and Nerds listeners. Reach out today and get a free domain name and website hosting for the first year. You can get their website essentials package, includes domain name, website hosting, backup and security free for the first year with any website purchase. This is valued at $330 a year. Choose a website designed to bring your author brand to life. You can find more details about this special offer at jinand.co/wordsandnerds. Welcome to the 2024 series of the Words and Nerds podcast. I'm Danny B, author, publisher, and your podcast host. With over 1 million plays, thanks to you, listeners, readers, writers, creatives, teachers, librarians, and book lovers, thank you for coming along for the journey where we bring you relaxed and real conversations about writing and creativity. If you love an episode, you can leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook at Danny V Words and Nerds Podcast. Or you can check out my brand new website designed by Jin & Co at dannyv.com.au.
Hi everyone, I'm Alex Duke, a West Australian crime writer. Welcome to Words and Nerds. Today I'm speaking with one of my favourite authors, Gary Disher. Gary's crime novels are an annual delight. They've shown us all manner of crooks, lowlives, thieves, good cops, bad cops, victims and heroes, all with sharp prose that finds the tension and suspense baked into everyday Australian life. Gary's latest standalone crime novel, Sanctuary, his 60th novel, I'm told, is out early April from Text Publishing. Gary, welcome to Words and Nerds.
Great to be here, Alex. Thanks.
So to kick off the conversation, can you tell me a little bit about this new book, Sanctuary?
Okay, it's a standalone. I'm probably best known for my different series, the Wyatt series, the Peninsula series, the Hirsch series. But often what happens is that a character will tap me on the shoulder who's appeared in an earlier book. And Grace, the main character, is a professional thief. A burglar, but she will attend valuable stamp and coin expos to see if she can steal from them and so on. So, and she appeared in one of the Peninsula novels, the Inspector Chalice novels, Whispering Death, as a minor character. But she just intrigued me ever since, kept tapping me on the shoulder, as Hirsch did, because the first Hirsch novel was supposed to be a standalone. Anyway, she kept tapping me on the shoulder and I wrote a standalone story about her. She might crop up again in future novels, I don't know. But in this one, she's on the run. She attends a stamp expo in Brisbane and sees a man across the crowd who's her foster brother from their teenage years. But there's bad blood between them, so she runs, and now he's looking for her, and she turns up in a small town in the Adelaide Hills, gets a job working for a woman who sells antiques. But we realise later, as the book progresses, that someone's looking for her too. So it culminates with the two nasty guys, one a lot nastier than the other, coming there to find them, having to outwit them, etc.
Great. So
that was a happy ending, sort of.
I'm happy to say that I got a chance to read the novel before this chat, and as expected, it's great. They're always great, these books you write. And by the way, Gary, listeners can't see, but I did just look over my shoulder to see a copy of Whispering Death on my bookshelf. Because I hadn't realised that we'd actually seen Grace before. But Grace, and also the character who we're introduced to as Erin, who she works for, both outsiders, always looking over their shoulder on the fringes of society in slightly different kind of ways. These sorts of outsider characters are all through your work. Even, often your police characters are outsiders in their own way. What is it about outsider characters that intrigues you?
I think possibly because they're forced to act alone. Even a police character, they depend on a team of fellow officers, but someone like her, she's a one officer police station in the outback. He's an outsider in the sense of not having any colleagues to work alongside, but also because he's from the city. And these sorts of characters, I think, can see a situation with fresh eyes because they're always alert for something that might go wrong. Always trying to work out, how can I fit in here? Where does the danger lie? That sort of thing. I think that's part of the appeal of the outsider character. Certainly Grace, she knows that the law is after her. She'll be arrested for previous crimes. She knows that bad guys she's outwitted in the past will be after her for revenge too. So wherever she goes, she's an outsider and she's always looking for the risks.
Yeah, and I think one of the one thing about your books that I've always really enjoyed is there's quite a diverse type of character in them. You might have Hirsch, who's, as you said, he's the cop in the outback who is, like a really decent sort of guy. Not perfect, but no one is. But he's a decent kind of guy. Grace is a, fairly decent person, I would say, as well. As is Aaron. Then you have for lack of a better word, the bad guys, who range from more flawed to just outright nasty and horrible. And each book I think that you write has almost this spectrum of outsider characters who are motivated by looking over their shoulder for different reasons, I would suggest. So it certainly expresses itself in a really rich, rogues gallery of outsiders and oddballs.
I must admit, as a writer, I have a great deal of fun creating those characters. I don't want them to be caricatures, though.
Mm.
Take the Aaron's ex-husband in Sanctuary. He committed acts of domestic violence against her, and that's why she's on the run, why she's in hiding. But he's also admires an American influencer, a bit like Andrew Tate. I was drawing on those news stories about Andrew Tate, the British influencer who's about under arrest in Romania and about to be sent back to the United Kingdom to face rape charges. But he's influenced so many young men in particular around the world about the way to treat women is to, just keep them under the thumb and all those things. He's a really nasty character. So my character in Sanctuary admires someone like him. But I wanted to be true. I know that there must be young men like that around who get their messages from the internet about get their guidance from the internet about how to be a man, etc., etc. So I'm drawing on those sorts of things to flesh him out. There are areas of vulnerability in him too. He's always sensed that women don't quite like him and nothing's ever worked out for him properly. So, rather than just be black and white with these sorts of characters, I try to show other aspects of their character, which may not be realistic from our point of view, so-called normal people, but it's the things that make them tick that interest me.
Yeah, and I, with that particular character, very much not a caricature at all, and I would say that these points of vulnerability make him, I would say, quite scary in a way, because there's all the bad stuff about him that you sort of talk about, all here the people he admires, his views and this sort of thing, but it's the that humanizing factor that makes him a little bit more real, and to my mind therefore a little bit more actually scary, because it's like, oh, these people are real.
yeah
if he was just a mustache twirling
we don't think like they do, but it's scary to try and understand what the channels of thought that drive them.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, Andrew Tate is obviously, like him particularly, is a, you know, obviously quite a modern thing just in the first few years. But if we wind back to your first crime novel, Kickback, which I believe was released in 1991 and features the other professional thief, you mentioned Wyatt. Over that period of time, I'm wondering if you can talk about what's changed in crime writing, in the way the audience views the genre, how publishers view the genre, and how a particularly good example with this novel, Sanctuary, is it features two women at the center, how the role of women in the genre has changed over that time.
I think there's been huge changes. I think in the earlier era of crime fiction, they were whodunits. A simple puzzle would be posed: who committed the murder? Various types of whodunit, of course. You had the tough Los Angeles private eye series of novels as well, but they are also kind of whodunit. But I think that the main question that's changed is, why done it, or what manner of person done it now? So a greater interest in criminal psychology, in what drives humans, ordinary humans to go off the rails, for example. So we had a series of psychological mysteries from people like Barbara Vine and so on, in which there may not even be an investigator, but it's a study of how ordinary people go off the rails, how there's some sort of corruption in a family, for example. So there have been different sorts of approaches to crime writing over the years. We have so-called schools of writing. There's the Scandi Noir, which I think is probably still very interesting and still being watched on TV, for example, and Joe Nesbo and people like that are still being read. But it's not as powerful as it used to be. In Australia, we have the Outback Noir school of writing, like my character Hirsch and like Jane Harper's novels and Chris Hammer's novels and so on. But perhaps that'll have its day one day eventually. And the types of investigators are changing too. They're not always private detectives, amateur detectives, or cops. Could be anybody, like a newspaper reporter in the Chris Hammer's first novel, for example. So different types of investigators, and they're no longer superheroes. If we take someone like Miss Marple or Marlowe, they have no kind of personal or social dimension. They just super. Miss Marple's a super reasoning machine. Marlowe's clever in his own way, but we have no sense of these characters having elderly parents that they're worried about, or messy love lives, or stale cheese in the fridge. Whereas our modern heroes, I think they're closer to us. Ultimately, they tread where we fear to tread, but we can relate to them. And I think that's been a very important shift in crime fiction. They're the most, and Australian crime fiction, I think, is growing. It's in a very healthy state. I remember about 15 years ago, publishers were moaning, saying that no one was buying Australian crime fiction. It's had its day, because back then the Cliff Hardy novels and so on were very popular, and I was starting to emerge on the scene, and it seemed to be healthy, and then there seemed to be a lag. But in fact, the lag hasn't happened. It's going from strength to strength. The Australian Crime Writers Association is pretty strong. Sisters in Crime is very strong and active. There are new women writers coming on all the time, and Australian writers are being published overseas quite successfully in recent years.
Mm.
So there have been big shifts, I've noticed. Yeah,
which is great. It seems to have, in Australia, it's really, you know, become its own thing that should be around for a while. With that,
I think that just on on that topic, crime writing is now a very popular writers' festival, literary festival option. It didn't used to be like that. A long time ago, I was on the Spoleto Arts Festival in Melbourne committee. It changed its name afterwards to the Melbourne Arts Festival or whatever, or the Melbourne Writers Festival. And I suggested that Peter Corris should appear. And there was outrage amongst my fellow committee members that it's crime writing, that's junk writing.
Did they know who you were?
What's that?
Did they know who you were when they said that?
Oh, no, they didn't know who I was. Well, I had a tiny bit of a reputation. That's why they invited me to be on the committee. But So that shifted. It just shows that that no one's ashamed about liking crime fiction and reading it and seeing that it's a serious genre. It tells us about the world we live in. In many ways, literary fiction doesn't do that. Literary fiction might do other interesting things like explore how prose can be used, creating atmospheres, exploring ideas and characters and so on. But sometimes it doesn't tell us about the world we live in, whereas crime fiction does.
Yeah, and I would note, you know, you mentioned Chris Hammer. I haven't watched it. To be fair, I'm not sure if it's actually been broadcast. I only mentioned this because I saw in the news that season 2 of his of a TV adaptation of Scrublands has been commissioned to play on TV. So that tells you something. When a genre goes from, you know, a genre of novels goes from, you know, selling well to then people stumping up serious money to adapt it for TV, you know, it's doing pretty well, I'd say.
And a lot of Peter Temple's books made it to the small screen too.
That's true. Yeah. With the you know, with speaking about crime writing changing over the years or evolving, has your own approach to your own work changed over the years?
I think it probably has. I'm a much more confident plotter now. I'm a planner. I have to say that outright. A lot of my colleagues say they don't plan. It's a kind of voyage of discovery, but I tried that approach with the first Wyatt novel, and I just wrote myself into corners that I couldn't get out of. And so I now plan in great detail, and I can come up with sort of complex situations. Not that the books are hard to read, but I can have a lot of things going on, and we realise later in the novel as it progresses how all these things are linked together. Like in the Hirsch novel, he might be looking at several local crimes because he's just a country cop. Or not necessarily crimes either, incidents, a family breakdown or a dog biting somebody or whatever it might be. Then later in the novel, I show how they have influenced other crimes and might lie at the back of the main crimes in the book.
Mm.
I'm getting better at that sort of thing, and I like doing it. Learning to stay a step ahead of the reader, using buried secrets and using turning points and withholding tactics and all those sort of plotting and tension generating craft aspects of writing I'm getting better at. I'm more interested now in what makes people tick, the psychology behind mass movements. Like in the most recent Hirsch novel, it's the growth of far right movements in Australia, and allied with that is the anti-vaxxer and COVID denial sort of thinking. I'm interested in why do people think that way, and in a future Hirsch, I want to write about religious cults, those small cults that can appear in rural areas because it's out of sight. They may not have a huge following, but nasty stuff happens in these cults. And I'm interested in why would someone join a cult? What's the thinking? So the psychology of crime has become much more interesting to me as I go ahead.
Well, yeah, I suppose particularly after COVID, you know, the world over the past few years has been fraying a little bit, and people have become a bit more backed up against the wall with their particular ideology, and of COVID, you know, certainly didn't help that. So there seems to be a lot of simmering tensions out in the community. Of course, there always has, but perhaps more so than there used to be, and that obviously can translate into a successful crime novel much better than if everyone was just getting along and there was no problems at all. One thing that is, you know, you mentioned, you know, for example, you mentioned Philip Marlowe, which, you know, the classic LA noir novel, which very much of their own time and, you know, probably about 80 years old by now. One of the big differences between novels written of that time and novels written now is the technology change. You know, everyone has a mobile phone, everyone has the internet. You can Google something on your mobile phone instantly. I'm wondering if the over the course of your novels, the change in technology has, if you have to really consciously factor that into how you do things, particularly if you're talking about plotting.
Oh, yeah, it's become a big issue for me. Take, for example, the Wyatt novels. I wrote six back in the 1990s and another three in more recent years. Wyatt's a professional crim. He robs banks and payroll vans. He often puts a gang together. There's always someone who betrays him and he has to get his revenge. They're simple novels at that level. But if it's going to be a professional like this, Rob, getting into a bank or a payroll van, he needs technical know-how. And poor old Gary Disher, the author, has to do that kind of research. And sometimes it just gets too complicated, and I think, okay, I can't write about this stuff. It's going to take pages of description. The reader's going to get bored. And how is he going to get hold of that information? And will he get an expert to work with him who knows this sort of stuff? I can do that, I suppose. But it reminds me of some of those caper films we see on TV or in the cinema, where they've got little laptops and they're plugging into the wiring of a building and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's I can't go along down that path. So for Wyatt, who's an old style crim, he's finds himself having to find simpler sorts of jobs because the author, Gary Disher, is too lazy or too defeated by modern technology to take him down those paths. And I realise, looking back at those old Wyatt novels, that a guy like him these days would be relying a lot on a mobile phone, but this was pre-mobile phone era, or early mobile phones, which would be clunky things. And you had wankers walking down the street with them, but now everyone's got one.
Now everyone's a wanker.
And the tiny, yeah. that sort of technology, the limitations of it and the uses of it, sits heavily on my shoulders when I'm writing these books. Even a Hirsch novel, he's an outback cop, simple outback cop, but communication has got to be a vital thing if he's way out where there's no signal, phone signal. So what kind of devices can he use? So I have to do that. Those sorts of questions are easily solved. I just make a phone call or do Google it or something like that. But it does factor into the plotting. What if he reaches an area where there's no signal? How's that going to affect the plot, the storyline? It's a setback. It might allow the bad guy to get away, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it impinges on the plotting, definitely.
I suppose one of the advantages of the outback, outback stuff is that it's one of the few places, you know, certainly in Australia, but, you know, in the world, where you can believably strip technology away and be in a space where a character can't just Google how to get out of a situation. They actually have to use their wits. So that's, you know, I suppose an advantage of the genre. Speaking about, like, you know, to stay with what you were just saying, can you tell me a bit about your research process more broadly?
Research process?
Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. Well, at a very basic level, I collect newspaper clippings. So, for example, this future Hirsch novel that I'm going to write about cults in rural areas, I've got newspaper clippings going back years. And I use them as a springboard or get to try and get a feeling for how the plot might go, what this crime elements of it might be. So, but that's, you know, easily sourced material. I just happened to be reading the Melbourne Age of a morning and start clipping out an article that might appear at that level. I've got my mobile phone next to me as I'm writing because I might have to very quickly look up something. I write longhand. The first draft is always longhand, so I'm not on the computer, so I use my phone as a computer and Google something if I need an immediate answer, that is. Otherwise, I make notes to myself to follow things up. I'm a little bit lazy. I take shortcuts, make things up and hope they work. But if it's absolutely necessary, I make phone calls. The police are often grateful to be asked how they work. I never go through the media office because you get stonewalled there. But if I ring up my local police station or even go in and front up to the counter and just ask, I'll usually get a good reception. I think the police often feel maligned, and it's good that they like it if someone's taking an interest. They're the main ways I do the research.
Yeah, I once called the media office of the West Australian Police and got a very sternly worded, you know, F off. Basically,
yeah.
What's the your novels are really rich with you know, just like little details that, you know, just they're small details, but just enough to make to give something color and make it come to life, and I suppose you know, provide authenticity as well. I'm guessing, you know, a lot of those sort of small details are too specific enough to be made up necessarily. So I'm wondering if there's, you know, what's the strangest real life thing from your researching that you've been able to work into a novel?
Okay. I can't on the surface think of something, but on that, to answer that topic, I'll answer it a different way. First, I think I've got a very visual memory, very visual imagination. I can't start writing a book until I can almost hear someone talking and see them walk across the room in my mind. I was working on the next Hirsch before this call with you this morning, and one of the characters it's a hot, dry, dusty day, and Hirsch has come upon someone who's lost on a back road, and they share a glass of water together and get chatting, and the woman he's sitting with is brushing flies away from the corner of her eye that are seeking moisture. So I often do that sort of thing because it suddenly brings the reader into the scene. The reader can imagine what it's like to brush persistent eyes away from your flies away from your eyes because they're seeking the moisture on a hot day. But what it really goes back to is very early in my writing career, I only had maybe 6 stories published in magazines. I won a creative writing scholarship to Stanford University in California, and I jumped in the deep end with a short story at the beginning of that year, and it got pulled apart by the class. They hated it. But someone in the class She'd had two stories published in the New Yorker, which is the pinnacle of achievement if you're an aspiring writer in the United States, even if you're an established writer. She said, "Your writing suffers from sensory deprivation." It's a simple story about a woman going into a pub, not a crime story, sees her old boyfriend on the other side of the pub, and she decides over the course of 10 pages, thinking about the relationship, she's moved on. She doesn't have to go and say hello. She doesn't have to hook up with him again. Just a slight shift. That's all you need in a short story. You don't need a car chase. And but the woman who said your writing suffers from sensory deprivation said, "It's all up in your head probably, but it's not on the page yet." She said, the best way to do that is to appeal to the reader's senses. She said, "I can't hear the jukebox in the corner of the pub. I can't smell the cigarette smoke. I can't taste the salt on the pretzels or the peanuts. I can't feel a squelch under my feet because someone spilled beer in the carpet." And it was the best, most useful writing lesson I ever learnt, how to appeal to the reader's senses, how to get them to smell things and see things, even if it's a character, let alone describing a bedroom or something. And now it's sort of second nature to me, but
yeah,
I hadn't realised I was doing it back then.
And I would I think the sensory sort of prompts or whatever, often they like your example just before about the woman brushing the flies from her eyes, it's things that can be very mundane. They don't have to be very dramatic. It's just the real specific mundane potentially thing that makes people go like, ah, just clicks in somehow, which is pretty interesting. But of course you're not just a crime author. You've worked in various other genres over your career. Can you tell me a little bit about your career beyond crime? And I'd say ask this partly for my own sake, because I've read, I think, all your crime novels, but only your crime novels. So I'm not really familiar with your work beyond those.
Okay. I'm trained as a historian, in fact. So I've written some Australian history textbooks for schools early in my career, a couple of how to write books. And in terms of fiction, I have 12 books for children and teenagers, novels, two or three short story collections, and about four or five actually, so-called literary or general fiction novels, a couple set during the Second World War. And I got the idea from those when I was doing the research for the history textbooks. For example, I was commissioned to write a book about Australian daily life during the Second World War. And I went to the State Archives and the War Memorial and all those places to do the research. And I found a letter by a woman on a Kimberley cattle station. All the menfolk had gone off to war, and most of the women and children of the Kimberleys had been sent down to Fremantle or Perth or wherever. But she stayed on, and one day she looked out her kitchen window and saw this strange group of Europeans straggling across the plain towards the farmhouse. And they were Dutch refugees who'd been from Java, who'd been shot down by the Japanese, and the plane had crash landed on the beach. It was just such a wonderful image of this lonely woman on a lonely cattle station in the middle of the Second World War. The Japanese have shot down a Dutch DC-3 just a few kilometres from the farmhouse. And so that idea sat in my head for ages until I found a way to write it as a novel. It's called Past the Headlands, the novel. That's just one example. Another. I was reading when I was doing history research, read a little clipping about in a very old newspaper, a rural newspaper about 100 years old, about a three-year-old girl being sold by a struggling outback family of 11 or 12 kids to a passing scrap merchant and his wife in a horse and cart. That's all the story said, but I began to imagine that little girl and what her life might be like. Obviously, horrible things happened to her, but it had to be, the story wasn't worth telling unless she had an indomitable spirit.
Mm.
So, yeah, there have been those sorts of books other than the crime novels and short story collections.
Yeah, great. Well, as I understand it, despite the number and array of books, novels that you've released, and you've also received a lot of critical acclaim over your career, I must say. As I understand it, your first bestseller was the 2019 novel piece featuring Hirsch, the Outback Cop that we referred to before. How has that? Has there been like a marked shift in your career since the release of that novel?
I think so. Yeah, for the first time, I was on bestseller lists, not to the level of Jane Harper or Chris Hammer, I must say, but by my own standards, and Australian publishing standards, they were on bestseller lists. So I was reaching new readers, and my publisher, Text Publishing, were publicising me to a greater deal than before, greater degree than before. And that, I feel a bit cynical about that, but obviously publishers can't promote everybody all the time to the same level, but it does show that publicity helps. So I'm earning new readers all the time, and it's been great for me. At this very late stage in my career, in my writing career, I'm starting to make a living from writing.
Wow!
All for decades, I've just struggled to get by, but now I'm starting to earn a bit.
Well, now you've with your backlist as well. That's it. It reminds me of look, perhaps we're not talking the same sales numbers necessarily, but Ian Rankin, I think, had a similar story where he had 10 Rebus novels under his belt before one hit, hit, and that sort of worked out to be quite good in a way, because people didn't have to wait for him to write the next one. He's just like, they're all there, like they're available for purchase right now.
I think he had a nice turn of phrase about that. He said I was an overnight success with my 10th book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and yeah, from my point of view, like I have seen, because I was been reading your work before 2019, but I've certainly seen a marked shift in the presence that you have in the publishing landscape, which is great. It must be great and very well deserved. You mentioned just before that you were working on the new Hirsch novel, which is great, but I have to ask, for my own selfish reasons, will we ever see a return of Wyatt?
I'd like to, yeah. I've got ideas for Wyatt's, but it may not be for another 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah, but I do like Wyatt. We never get to know Wyatt, which is part of the appeal of Wyatt. So when I write those books, I'm having much more fun with the minor characters than with Wyatt. I think if we knew that Wyatt had an alcoholic father and his mother was a prostitute or left the family when he was only 5 years old, suddenly Wyatt's vulnerable and he's not Wyatt anymore. So I quite like writing about an enigmatic character, but to make up for it, I have to use my creative juices, working on the minor characters.
Yeah,
but I do like reading caper novels and watching caper films. So, and I think it taps into that side of us that would like to commit the perfect crime. I don't think these books could work if we didn't have that hidden side in us.
No, of course. And yeah, they are, caper or sort of heist stories. But as we, mentioned right at the start of our chat, he's certainly a professional and a great operator, but you never really get the sense that he's, you know, pulled off the absolute perfect thing and he's got everything he needs. He's always on the back foot, in a sense. And there's something about that character that, you just kind of sit... I'm sitting in, in Perth, and you just sort of think, like, he's just around somewhere in some suburb in Australia planning something or laying low, and he's ready to do something, you know. Do you know what I mean? He's just out there somewhere.
I suppose you're right. He's there in my head like that too.
Mm.
And I'll find the perfect job for him.
Awesome. Great. All right, Gary. Well, thank you very much for your time. So everyone, Gary's new novel, Sanctuary, it's a really excellent read, as are all his books. That's out in early April, I believe, from Text Publishing. So it'll probably be out when this podcast is put out. So everyone, get out there, get a copy, have a read. If you've never read Gary before, then this is a great, it's great a place to start as any, and you'll be richly rewarded going through his back catalog. So thank you very much for your time, Gary.
Thanks, Alex, and good luck with your own writing.